This is a report of interview with Rear Admiral W. What's your second initial, Bill?
M.
W. M. for Mike Landymore in Victoria, British Columbia. You know the form, Elma. Thanks for having me down to your hotel this afternoon, Bill. For the record, I've just talked to the Admiral about the tape. We were going to go on to the Korean War, period. I then suggested that since other of his brother admirals had gone on to the unification oblique integration time, he might want to start there and go backwards. He has said that he would not like to do that without his notes because he get the chronology wrong, so we're going to talk about the... We're going chronologically now. We're going to talk about the Korean War and on.
Yeah.
Yes, said the Admiral. All right. Right after the war, I think you were in the cruiser, or during the war.
Yes, yeah. Uganda.
Yeah. We didn't do much on Uganda in the past tape, I don't think, did we? She was brought back by that signal that only volunteers could serve.
That's right. I don't think so. I don't remember how much what went into the first day.
No,
but
it's in
that
the
is true.
It's in the computer now, and it won't be out for a couple of days yet.
No.
Anyway, Captain Mingy thought badly about having to go back.
Everybody did. Anybody who had any sense felt badly about it, because at the time we were made to volunteer or else given the opportunity anyway. It was perfectly clear that the naval war in the Pacific was won. Now we were operating with the British Pacific Fleet as one task group in four, and I'm willing to say it. I venture to say that it's the biggest fleet that's ever been in one piece anywhere at any time. It's enormous. There were four task groups, each consisting of each one of these groups had upwards of 30 destroyers, maybe as many as 5 cruisers, 3 or 4 battleships, and 4, 5, 6 aircraft carriers. This is one group. Fantastic fleet.
There were 5 of them.
And there were 4 of them.
4 of them.
And they were operating as one fleet. They weren't all over the place. They were 4 groups traveling in circular formations with 1, 2, 3, 4 in a row, and the admiral in charge would tell one of his groups to get in station. You know, I mean, it was just like a and of course they had difficulty keeping in station. They're all flying off at different times, so these groups would be turning up into the wind and flying on into the wind, and some of them would get a little bit out of station, and it didn't take the admiral long when he knew the flying operations were over to...
Who was it?
To tell him to pause it.
Who was the admiral?
Don't ask me. I don't know who the American admiral was.
We can look it
now,
up.
I could, at least without looking it all up.
I'll check it. All right, we're on again.
Well, what I was going to say...
Anyway, they stretched from horizon to horizon, the fleet.
Oh, but further than that. You couldn't... I think probably about 65 sea miles from one end to the other. But what we could see on our radars, we could see our own group, and we could see if there was one on either side of us, we could generally see about half the circular formation of the one on each side. But that's all we could see. But of course, we knew they were all there. They were all flying, and everybody had to keep their aircraft sorted out now, that sort of thing. Anyway, what I was getting to was the fact that in those days, flying was by day. There was no night flying, so that the very first light their sorties going off, and bringing them back on at dusk, and then the flying was shut down for the night. But this enormous number of aircraft was taking off every day. Well, you could imagine that. I guess there were 20 aircraft carriers, all told. About that, anyway. Mm-hmm. And targets were so hard to find, proper military targets, they weren't doing indiscriminate bombing of towns or things. Any mechanical thing that moved, a train or a bus or a lorry or marshalling yards, things like that. And then, of course, they had pinpointed industrial targets, those kind of things. But targets became so hard to find that they were coming back and having to jettison their bombs because they couldn't make it. And there was precious little opposition. So anybody with any sense could say, well, as far as the war at sea is concerned, maybe there'd be some kamikazes and that sort of thing attacking, but the war has been won. So if you've given the choice of volunteering, what you're really deciding is not whether you're going to fight the war, but whether you're going to live with the fact that you didn't volunteer the rest of your life. And I was gunnery officer, and I had some very good chiefs, an extremely good chief gunner's mate, a fellow called Barker. And we got the whole of the staff together, all the chiefs and POs, and that's almost exactly what I said to them. You know as well as I do that we're not running into any opposition now. There's no Japanese fleet to come to sea. There's precious little air attack left in the Japanese Air Force to get at us. And what they have got left, they're going to try to preserve as a fighter thing to prevent landings or what have you. Our own aircraft are having difficulty finding targets. So the only thing is your mental state 20 years from now when you were one who didn't volunteer. And I don't think that most people took that approach, but certainly we did in the gunnery department. And I don't know how people voted, but I know that when the vote came, there were more people who voted to go home.
Then voted to stay?
Mm-hmm. Then oh yes, much so. We had to go back, and I think that was very sad. And I can tell you this, that later on, a number of the people who didn't volunteer, who were good friends of mine, no longer wanted my friendship. They were
embarrassed,
ashamed. And that's exactly what I said would happen to them. And I'm sorry, I have to go. Now it's a different story. We've made our peace again, and it's too far away to be the wall between two friends. But and as far as I was concerned, that wasn't my battle. I didn't have to battle myself about it, but they did, and they thought that I was, and all of us. Hugh Pull and other people who were all, of course, volunteers, so that we were looking down our noses at them after the war was over. And I don't think anybody would have done that deliberately, but I think that's what happened, and a lot of friendships failed. It was too bad. Yeah. Now it seems to be the Uganda reunion sort of bring people back together. But when it comes up, nobody's happy about it. Man was a non-volunteer. He just assumed nobody knew about him.
You fueled on the way back where?
Went to Honolulu.
Was there any feeling in Honolulu against Uganda?
Well, they wouldn't have a clue why we were coming back.
No.
It wasn't a public thing at all. But what is desperately misfortunate about it, or unfortunate about it, is that if we'd stayed for those extra 3 or 4 weeks, E.R. Mingy would have been at the signing of the surrender as the Canadian representative. Mm-hmm. And that really would have meant something to Canada. And you must realize that, that I'm talking to that machine when I talk that way, is that we were the only organized Canadian force in the Pacific, land, air, or sea, as far as I know, after Hong Kong fell. I don't know. I haven't researched it all that much, but I don't think there was any army unit. I don't think there was any air force unit fighting in the Pacific, only the Uganda. Now, of course, the Hong Kong people who were taken prisoner, they were properly representative of Canada, but I don't think there were any other formed units. Lots of individuals who were in the RN or in the USN or in the US Air Force or in the Army and that sort of thing, but nothing that Mackenzie King had put his stamp on. So, well,
let's leave that then.
But that is history, and I think that's one of these. No one can understand why a government will do such stupid things like that and say we can't make any exceptions. And I couldn't understand why somebody in the Naval Service just didn't tell them where to go. Anyway, that's it.
It's pretty political at that level, in the Naval Service and out. So you came home, you did a couple of cruises, peacetime cruises in Uganda,
that's
I think.
Yes, I went around South America and I went to Alaska.
Yeah.
Then I left.
I guess efficiency fell off after VJ Day. I worded that badly. You know what I mean? The impetus wasn't there anymore, and I guess you were running down on complement.
Oh, we had the ship was. I don't think we could have properly manned one turret. The ship was turned into a training ship. Really, we had about a whole flock of ordinary seamen, you know, officer candidate types on board.
Yes,
and it was really a training cruise, and the only gunnery we did was with subcalibers. We didn't fire the 6-inch, and I don't. I don't think we had anything like a reasonable balance of all of the rates necessary for an action situation. Oh no, we couldn't have fought a battle.
No, you were hard put to keep the 6-inch and your 4-inch system maintained, I would think.
I don't remember that especially at all.
I can imagine it.
6-inch turrets were very easy to maintain. They're all hydraulic, so they didn't get rusty, and all the moving parts were all undercover, and that wasn't a problem. 4-inch might have given a little trouble.
And you went where after Uganda?
To Ottawa in warfare and training. Gunnery officer on the staff of.
I filled that position some years later.
Did you?
Yeah.
Who was your boss? I'll interview you.
Ted McDermott.
Oh, yeah.
Shaky McDermott.
Yes, yes, yes.
The only man who ever wore out his suits from the inside. Is what the troops said about Shaky.
He really was shaky, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
I think he was in the hooch, wasn't he?
Towards the end, yes. But he overcame that and got out. But he was shaky long before that. He noted shaky McDermott. I don't know if he was nervous or not. I can't imagine a nervous gunnery officer, but he was highly strung anyway.
Yes, I remember him quite well. Well, that's where I went, and Duncan Raymond was the boss.
Yeah.
And I was the deputy.
Yeah.
DDWT, big deal.
Yeah. Well, nothing much happened, I guess, in that appointment.
Just interesting things, but not. It was all post-war. You know, trying to get things sorted out where naval divisions would be made to specialize in what and the equipment for it and so on.
Yeah. Which brings us up to about 48.
Well, immediately after there, I went to the Naval Staff College. Then I went to the Joint Services Staff College.
Immediately after?
Yes.
1 month?
Yes. In those, in, I think that that was the sort of format after the Joint Services Staff College was opened, that one of the people who went to the Naval Staff College would go on there. And I was the one who got the lucky deal. It was very nice to do them both, because then you had a year away and you had certain customs privileges, which were helpful. And then I came back as Director of Manning. The appointment was Director of Manning and Personnel Statistics.
So we're up to nearly 1950.
Yeah, nearly.
It's on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Korean War is about to break out.
Yes.
Now, Andy Fulton said to me, as a Vice Admiral, when I did a tape with him, he was also a 2.5 in the office when I was up there. He said, the Korean War was salvation of Canadian Navy. Things had run down between 45 and 50. Another officer said that a whole bunch of RCNVRs stayed on 2 years appointment, and they didn't give a damn, they just didn't want to go back to civilian life, and they just did the minimum. This is Bill Evans over in Vancouver. Various people, I was away doing a gunnery course. A lot of people have said things of that nature, that the Korean War was a great thing for the RCN and bringing us back up to fighting efficiency. What would you say?
Well, I would have guessed that the date would be about 6 months before the start of the Korean War. The government told us that the complement of the RCN would be 7,500 officers and men. And it had to be brought rapidly down to that. That was the limit. So, my goodness, it was just like the pre-war days. And this happened. I got that directive as Director of Manning, you see, because this is they told me what proportion of that would be men, and the men belonged to me, and somebody else had the officer. There was no, at my level, there was no arguing about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. And we agonized to keep just as many ships as possible in commission, and they were really right down to bare bones. But that was the deal. And then when the Korean thing broke out and the government decided to support it, well, the whole aspect changed totally. And instead of us being told to get rid of people as fast as we could, we were told to recruit as fast as we could. Not only were we told to recruit as fast as we could, we were given targets to meet. And so that the minister could go into the house and give everybody a splendid picture of how rapidly we were coming back at a strength. But it was the most uneconomical and the most stupid way to get back, because all you could do was recruit people who you could recruit easily. And those were the people who fitted into categories which didn't require too much gray matter. So we got entirely out of balance. And people said to me, we don't care what they are, who they are, what branch they belong to, get the numbers. Now, over the West Coast, they had so many stokers, they had enough to man a fleet 10 times the size of ours, stokers under training. Mm-hmm. Totally wasted. So that's the sort of thing that went on, but it was very bad. And this was all just flannel.
Yes. The first two destroyers sailed pretty promptly.
Oh, yes. Oh, I don't think there's any question of readiness. I think that all of the destroyers which were in commission on both coasts were very close to a complement that could run the ship quite effectively, and it only took maybe 30 or 40 men over to bring them up to their war complement. So getting ready was no problem for three destroyers on each coast. No problem.
We were there in July. The Army made it at platoon strength, I think, by December. They didn't get up to whatever their full strength was for another year.
They were almost a year behind.
The Air Force never got there.
That's
they
right.
They flew to Japan.
Transport.
Transport to Japan. So the Navy was ready.
That's right. Oh, it didn't take... I would have... If it had been a very different kind of war, if it had been a note break of World War II, I think we'd have had our whole fleet at sea in no time. And the nucleus we had of trained people was terrific. It wasn't a question of not having enough trained men; it was just enough. We had all the key people.
Sure, they were all
lots of ERAs and electrical technicians and that sort of thing. And very good people too. All the good people stayed on because they could see a career for themselves. We had a lot of Uganda first class people stayed on. They don't mean all the good people and all the bad people went out, and I don't mean it in that sense.
No.
But all the people who could see a good career. And liked the Navy and had some pride in the Navy, they hung around. They did very well.
When did you get there to Korea? You had Iroquois.
Oh, don't ask me to give
all
you
right.
the dates.
I'll look.
They're all in the book. And
they're
the ones in that Canada's War in Korea, whatever it's called, Naval War in Korea,
they're
all accurate.
I'll put that in, Alma. Or you'll put it in. I know you will.
But anyway, I went out from Halifax once and then came back and then went out again. But before I took Iroquois, we had to spend 2 or 3 months in off Norfolk testing a gunnery system. And so when I joined the Iroquois, we didn't go straight out. We had about very close to 3.5 months on that one excursion, just going down to Norfolk and blazing away every day and then coming back to Halifax.
So, the date you arrived in Korea, you went to Sasebo, I suppose, to start
yes.
with?
Yes.
And then what?
Well, for me personally, we no sooner arrived than there was a signal waiting for me saying I was to repair forthwith to Cure, to act as the president of a disciplinary court. Three men from other ships that had got into scrapes. And just before we went out, they had amalgamated the laws for the legal practices for the three services into one book. Do you remember that? QRCN and the Army, whatever it was, and the Air Force, whatever it was. And they were all put into one book, and so we all had more or less the same disciplinary act. And the rank structure for disciplinary courts had changed. Because originally, a commander would take a disciplinary court, but because the Army had colonels doing the equivalent, they rated them all up, and the Navy had to have a captain. Well, there was no captain within 3,000 miles. So I had to, with my tongue in cheek, send a little message off to say it was unfortunate that they couldn't put together a legal court with the staff that was available. So that, but I would go to Cure and set the whole thing up, and then and work with the judge advocate, and then I'll wait the arrival, knowing damn well they wouldn't. Anyway, so I sent my steward away to get shoulder boards changed, and the message did come straight back. I could almost hear them giggling.
You were made an acting captain?
Acting captain for 4 days.
Did you get your pay? It
cost me more to get my uniforms altered than it did paid to than the extra pay for the 4 days you gave me. But it was kind of fun anyway, just to have pull somebody's leg. But of course, I was quite right, because the first thing that would happen is the court proceedings would have gone back, and somebody had claimed they're not legal, that the structure was wrong.
Been thrown out.
It had been thrown out. So, that was it.
So your first patrol then?
Well, then, very soon after we got there, we were given a little bit of time to do some maintenance and get a little help from the Sasebo Yard, and then we started patrols. And our earlier ones were all on the west coast of the Penyang Do area, it's called.
Yes.
And it was an exercise in mine navigation. It was dense fog almost the entire time we were there. And we were messing around in very narrow channels between the islands. A wonderful experience for everybody. We got more confident traveling blind than we did when we could see.
Yes.
And it was there was some bombardment. Every now and again, the intelligence reports which were highly suspect most of the time. All the agents were double agents. So you really didn't know for sure what you were getting. But occasionally it would appear that there might be a little bit of authenticity to some of it, and you'd find that there were a couple of companies had landed up in some village, and so you'd have a go at it. And we invariably had air spotting,
yeah.
So the gunnery was, it was so good that I guess nobody wanted to live in those villages.
No.
We'd just take a whole village. But I didn't personally get very much satisfaction out of knocking them out.
No, I can see
that. It wasn't the kind of war that fitted into my book at all.
I've forgotten who your gunnery officer was.
Doug Tuck.
Yeah, Doug Tuck. A sharp customer, Doug, I think.
A very nice young man. He is the only member of the ship's company in our first trip to be decorated. Mm-hmm. You know the form on that. There's one DSC.
Per ship.
And usually the captain gets it.
Yeah.
Because he wants it.
Yeah.
But I thought Doug was more than worthy.
Oh, yeah.
So he got it in my ship. I was mentioned in dispatches.
Because I know you had Kai Bergel as number one, and I know Felix Quinn was there, of course, because he died there.
Yes, he was killed.
Mostly carrier operations on the West Coast, was it not?
Oh, there's quite a bit of, you know, carrier screening and the destroyer standing by to catch down pilots. But and I did quite a bit of that. But most of it really was inshore, in around the islands.
What Canadian ships were you with?
Nootka mainly. Crusader was there for a very short time while I was there, and he left before they left before I really got going. With John Bovey, that was they did very well on the East Coast again.
Well, yes.
The trains and things.
Train bashing.
Yes. And it was on the East Coast that I got hit, where Quinn got killed.
All right. Well, anything else about the West Coast before we move around to the East?
Well, I think that some of the things that we did were quite interesting. At least I think they were. One of them, operations that I got mixed up with, there were wolf packs, they were called, the North Korean, the South Korean sort of volunteers in the islands they were sort of reservists who were armed and organized, and they were defending the islands. And they had American advisors, youngsters, in this group up around where we were, Penyang Do area, where there were four Wolfpack units.
Army, these are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And South Korean men, and they were trained by local people. They didn't have any. They were all just machine gun, rifle, mortar, that kind.